This is the Real Business Podcast, where business gets personal. Presented by Mass Mutual. Hosted by Brian Trzynski, a certified exit planning advisor and director of business owner markets at Mass Mutual.
Welcome, everybody, to the Real Business Podcast, where business gets personal. I'm Brian Trzynski, your host, and I'm joined today by Roxanne Kofelt, who is a CPA and an expert in the area of dealing with divorce in a business. When that happens, we talk a lot about the five D's, and I don't think we talk enough about divorce as one of those five D's. We talk a lot about death and disability and departure. And I think this is a tremendously important topic that, you know, quite frankly, Roxanne, shame on me for waiting over a year to tackle. Probably should have did this one earlier, but welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Brian.
Just going to start off with a couple of statistics, and then we'll dive right into what folks need to know. I found this survey from Clarify Capital. They're an organization that provides loans to small business owners. And for businesses that experience a divorce, 57% said that their company has taken a financial hit, and 70% weren't able to focus on their work while they were dealing with divorce. So before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty of valuation and transfer, let's talk about the personal side of this, Roxanne. How does a divorce impact the personal well-being of business owners?
What I've seen, if you have a business that you have a good management team in place, that business should be able to run without you. A lot of the businesses that I'm working with are very small businesses. Usually, you know, the owner is very heavily involved. And if the owner is heavily involved, then the divorce, you know, he's being pulled in many different directions, and it's definitely going to affect the business. And not just that, but a lot of business owners purposely try to tank their business while the divorce proceeding is going on.
That's scary. And we're going to talk a little bit about how business owners try to influence, for a lack of a better word, their valuation during this time. You mentioned that that's something that business owners do. And the study also uncovered the fact that on average, businesses that are going through a divorce faced an average of $4,000 a month in revenue decline. So as a result of all that and everything that you just said, nearly one in 20 business owners closed their doors due to the financial brunt of a divorce that survey found, which, again, I just think that this is a topic that we really need to focus on. And I'm so glad to have you here to talk about it. And I think in our experience, Roxanne, you know, there's three major issues that arise when a spouse who owns a business is divorcing the other spouse. How are we going to handle the management and operations and control of the business during the divorce? What's going to be the income distribution of the business during the divorce? And then finally, how are we going to divide the business up at the end of the divorce? So let's just tackle those one at a time, Roxanne. Let's start with the first one. How important are operating agreements in determining the management, operations, and control of during a divorce? And what can business owners do sort of upfront when they start their business to make sure these things are in place?
Well, every business needs an operating agreement. I would say they're less important if you're like the sole owner, because obviously if you own 100% of the business, you're going to do whatever you want. If you are not the sole owner, then it's imperative that you have an operating agreement. And that can absolutely affect things in a divorce. Like just the other day, I had an attorney send me something, and, you know, she was talking about getting a valuation. And I said, you know, here's this operating agreement says that this guy was in business with, I think, two other people, or I don't know how many partners or shareholders he had, but the operating agreement said that if any of them wanted to get out of the business, they would get paid book value. So if that's the case, and this is a legal question, and I'm not an attorney, I'm an accountant, but I said to her, you know, maybe you need to ask the judge if this guy, if he gets out of the business, he's only going to get book value. Why would we even be calculating a fair market value? Because he can't get fair market value.
Yeah. And we see that in buy-sell agreements as well. Again, I'm not an attorney either. I don't necessarily review buy-sell agreements, but I know for a fact from people who do that when those buy-sell agreements stipulate a certain type of valuation, whether it's, you know, book value in that case, that's what the courts are going to go by.
Yeah. Well, not good if you think you want to sell that interest someday down the road, but good if you're getting divorced.
Yeah. So let's talk about the second one, the income distribution. And you kind of alluded to this when you mentioned a lot of business owners tank their business during a divorce. Yes. And I think this is where we'll dive a little bit deeper into that. So, you know, spouses who own businesses together sometimes attempt to create an economic hardship for the other spouse. I mean, that happens whether you own a business or not, unfortunately, in the cases of a lot of divorces. One owner may try to control or mismanage revenue and therefore the income in doing that. So how common is it for one spouse to attempt to cut off another spouse's income or threaten to do so? Maybe increase their pay, decrease the spouse's pay. Talk to me more about that phenomenon.
I think it's really common. The biggest thing that I see is a lot of times I get hired mostly by female attorneys and their clients are mostly female. And most often the wife is not the business owner, the husband is. Okay, but sometimes they've made the business 50-50 so they can say it's a woman-owned business or whatever. In Indiana, and I don't know about other states, but it's probably very similar in a lot of other states, the valuation date is the date of separation. So when somebody hires me to do a valuation, the valuation date is going to be that date of separation or date that they filed. And the business owner doesn't seem to realize this because then they want their business to be worth nothing because they don't want their spouse to get any. So then they start, maybe they're already cheating for income tax purposes, but then they start cheating even more usually to hide money from the other spouse. And maybe they're running expenses through there that aren't really expenses or they're not reporting income. And the thing is, I can usually find this. One time I had a case where the couple separated. It was right around the 1st of December. And she did the books. And this business was owned 50-50. She did the books. So she had all the QuickBooks or whatever it was up until the date of separation. She had all the financial statements. And the date of separation was the date of valuation. Well, this had a December 31st year end. As of December 1st, they were on track to do a little bit better than the year before. So everything was fine. And then all of a sudden in December, the business lost so much money that it only made $25 for the whole year. You know, I said, well, it really doesn't matter because I've got the financials as of December 1st, and that's the valuation date. So that's what we're going with. So, you know, it was all of his, whatever he did in December was for nothing. Had another case where the business was owned 50-50, and this dragged on and on and on in the courts, like for another year or two. And the wife would get the K-1 and it would said she got distributions of half the distributions, you know, thousands of dollars in distributions, which she didn't get. And so in the end, she had this big K-1 with all this income on it and supposedly distributions, but she didn't get any of that. And she had to pay tax on it. I said, well, you know, he took your distributions. That means you've got more than one class of stock. And he just violated the rules for having an S corporation, and he just inadvertently ended his S corporation. So we didn't report it. I think I reported it on her tax return, took it back out, and filed an explanation explaining why we were taking it back out, because the S corp didn't pay her the distributions and that they violated the one class of stock rules, and you know their S election should be terminated. And it never came back on her, so I'm guessing it came back on him.
And these rules do vary by state, absolutely. And I think one of the pieces of advice folks should walk away from is make sure you understand the rules of your particular state, because they do vary. The valuation date could either be the date of separation or the date of the filing.
Which maybe they're one and the same. You know, I'm not an attorney.
But usually they're not. And well, that's kind of where I'm going with this, right?
I think they might go, maybe the date of filing is the date of legal separation. Like I said, I don't know.
Yeah, but I think the takeaway is make sure you understand that. I'm just talking about people who I know that have gotten divorced. Sometimes people wait months after quote unquote separation to actually file. And think about all the damage somebody could do to the business.
That's true.
In those months before the filing actually takes place.
Yeah. Well, I hope we're not giving anybody ideas here.
Yeah. But again, my point is make sure you know the rules of your state, right? Make sure you understand, is it date of separation? Is it date of filing? Yeah. Are they one and the same? Just make sure folks, you do your research and you know.
And get a good attorney.
Yeah.
Because absolutely. They will know. You can't navigate this on your own.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So then the last question, and really kind of the ultimate question, I think here is around what happens to the business at the end of the divorce. You know, how is it going to be divided? We know there's several options. You know, one spouse may choose to buy out the other spouse's interest. The spouse may choose to sell the business and divide the proceeds. The spouse may choose to continue to operate together if it's an amicable divorce. I'm sure that that happens as well. Are there other options? You know, what do you typically see? If you could also touch on this too, Roxanne, when is the business considered marital property and how does that impact the transfer of ownership?
Well, I think that's a legal question and I'm not an attorney, but from what I understand, in Indiana, the business is marital property. It's, but
always.
I think that it would be, if you own the business before you entered the marriage, the value of the business at the time you entered the marriage would not be, and then any increase in the valuation would be, because it's whatever assets you came into during the period of the marriage. But I've never been asked to do a valuation at the beginning of the marriage, you know, so I don't know if they actually do that or not, because usually it's just the spouse gets half the business, not the business, but the value of the business. It's usually paid out in something else. If one spouse owns and runs the business, the other spouse isn't normally going to get that business. They're going to get some other asset. The owner may have to go out and take out a loan in order to pay the spouse their share.
Do you ever see situations where they take a note, just basically pay the spouse in installments, you know, some kind of buyout? We see that a lot in death situations or disability situations, right? Where they'll just do it in some kind of installment buyout over 5 years. Do you see that kind of a payout situation in divorce a lot?
I usually don't see the end result. And a lot of times, most of the time, I don't even know how it came out unless I happen to talk to one of the parties afterward and they tell me, or unless the lawyer happens to tell me. I had one, like maybe I have one say, oh, they accepted your valuation. Great, that's good to hear, you know, but they don't always tell me that. And one time, and the judge can do whatever they want, whether it makes sense to anyone or not. I had a case once where I testified on this woman's business, and basically, you'll understand, she had a job. She didn't have a business because it was a sole proprietorship, so she's not taking a salary, and the amount of profit is about what she would make in wages. So there's no business profit there over and above that to give any value to the business. So I testified that the business really, I think I had calculated it, and it came out to like $600, you know. And there was another expert on the other side, and he said the business was worth like $300,000. And I had educated the attorney that I worked for. This valuation that the other guy did was like seriously wrong. We're not talking just a mistake that you could fix. It was like go back to square one wrong. Okay. He'd included real estate in there that had a separate valuation that the business didn't even own. And there was just so many things wrong with it. So the attorney that I worked for, that I was hired by, he got the other expert to admit on the stand that his valuation was wrong, like totally wrong. And then later on, I happened to talk to, it was this woman's, the wife's new boyfriend told me that the judge had used the other guy's valuation, even though he admitted on the stand that it was wrong. It wasn't right. And I said, well, why on earth would he do that? And he says, I can only think that it was to punish the wife for having an affair. So you just never know what the judge is going to do.
Yeah, I think you kind of raised another interesting point there is obviously there's always going to be two parties here, right? Whenever there's a divorce, there's two parties who are attempting to resolve this. And just like with a marital home, right? Both parties are always going to attain their own valuation of what that asset is worth. How typically are those disputes resolved? Because I can imagine now what you just described is a pretty egregious difference.
I thought so.
But I can imagine, Roxanne, there's instances where the husband gets a valuation, it's $2 million. The wife gets one and it's $4 million. Do they meet in the middle?
I think that it's all going to depend on the testimony. Oh, it's been a while. I was in court on one and the other guy decided he had a valuation certification and he should know better. He decided that since the nephew built the guy's website, that then he was going to take 15% of the sales and just take them off because that's what the guy would pay Amazon, I think. If he was on Amazon, he would pay him 15%, or he would pay some marketplace 15%. So that 15% really belonged to the nephew for building the website, which that's nonsense, just flat out nonsense. So needless to say, we could tear his valuation apart pretty good. And then they got me on the stand and, you know, there was a dispute over how many hours the guy worked, because the wife had said, oh, he works like 2 hours a week. So I figured a salary of 2 hours a week because he didn't take a salary. And the other guy figured a salary at 40 hours a week. So I also could say, well, if he worked 40 hours a week, that would change this by X amount of dollars. You know, we would lower this value by X amount of dollars. But they get me on the stand and this attorney starts asking me about the office manager that's working 40 hours a week that supposedly is getting paid in distributions. And I'm like, no, because the office manager, whoever this person is not a shareholder. Distributions only go to shareholders. They don't go to employees. If there's an office manager, he is not getting paid in distributions. And she insisted he was. And the judge told her to drop it. He said, she already told you that he's not getting paid in distributions. But she wouldn't let up. And finally, it's like a light bulb went off in my head. And I'm like, do you mean to tell me he's got a full-time manager he's paying under the table? And she says, I'll ask questions. Thank you.
Yeah.
So yeah. Needless to say, then, you know, like the financial statements are all fraudulent.
Yeah, it's kind of like, be careful how you handle these situations, because you may bring to light things that you don't want to bring to light, even outside the divorce proceedings in these cases.
Yeah.
I'm sure if an attorney was joining us, the whole theory of clean hands, right? You always got to come to these proceedings with clean hands. And if you don't, it's never going to really go well.
Yeah, I don't think their hands are usually clean from what I've seen, because I usually, it's normal. There's certain things that we expect, you know, like the car that's written off as 100% business use that really isn't, you know, stuff like that. And we always make sure that, is the compensation reasonable? Is it too low? Is it too high? Is there a spouse that's working for free? Or I've seen spouses that are getting paid that don't do any work, and kids that are getting paid that don't do any work. And, you know, stuff like that. But then you get the really egregious stuff like, oh, I had a guy that it was just him, like a consulting business, one guy. Okay. But supposedly he was spending $300 a week roughly on office supplies at the grocery store. So needless to say, of course, I didn't have receipts. I just had his statements, but I wasn't buying that he had to buy that many office supplies. So I just looked at industry standards and I adjusted his office supplies. He wasn't happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure he was writing off his groceries.
Well, sure.
I'm pretty sure he
buys office supplies at the grocery store.
Yeah, well, it was one of those. It was like one. It wasn't Walmart, but it was like Walmart where you can buy groceries. And you can buy
okay.
One person doesn't need like $300 a week in office supplies.
So, Roxanne, you said something a little bit earlier I want to go back to, because I think it's a point that we should discuss a little bit, especially with your background in valuations, right? You mentioned earlier that when an individual has a business already and gets married, so basically they're going into the marriage with the business already established, most folks don't get a valuation at that time. And Roxanne, we know from our own research at Mass Mutual that we know that most business owners have no clue what their business is worth regardless, right? So we can safely make an assumption that, let's just say best case scenario, or maybe worst case, depending on how you look at it. Let's say only half of business owners who own a business and then get married know what their business is worth at the time that they get married. Do you think it's wise for a business owner to actually have somebody value the business, whether it's their CPA or a business valuator, if they already have a business at the time they get married, so that if this does happen where there is a divorce, there's much more likelihood that there's going to be a fair and equitable distribution at the time of the divorce? Because let's be real, 50% of marriages end in divorce. So I think business owners need to prepare for that possibility.
Yeah, I think it would be wise, but you know, I've only had it done once. I had a guy hire me to do a calculation because he was getting married and it was, I guess his lawyer wanted it, probably for a prenup or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would think, I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this space, but I would think that even if you're not going to do a prenup, I think at the basic best practice, at least knowing what your business is worth at the time of getting married is probably a wise idea.
I just agree.
Yeah.
It is. Not just that, but just for planning purposes anyway.
For sure. Yeah. Even beyond just play. So let's talk about this issue of double dipping. Double dipping refers to the idea that a spouse may be awarded twice on income generated from the business, right? So once the equitable distribution of assets is the first one, and then again, when calculating income for support, right? So if there's going to be some kind of alimony, there's going to be some kind of child support. Is this something that you see causing conflict you know, I'm already paying out my spouse, you know, why am I going to have to continue to pay support beyond what I'm paying out from the business?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, but I don't really see it because hardly anyone gets alimony anymore, at least not in the businesses that in the divorces that I'm working with. I mean, maybe you might have some clients like that, but my clients probably aren't wealthy enough to be paying alimony. And I think alimony is kind of a thing of the past because you don't have so many spouses that are like totally reliant on their spouse anymore. Most women, a lot of them will have some type of career where they're usually working.
Do you see any difference? Because there's a lot of women-owned businesses out there. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge the fact that it's not always the women buying out the men. It could very well be the other way around where the woman owns. Do you see any differences in the gender roles depending upon who is sort of the driver of the business or the majority owner of the business?
A lot of times I see them 50-50. I haven't, as far as divorces, I know a lot of women-owned businesses. I'm trying to think if I've done any divorces with women-owned businesses. And I don't know that I have. It's like, usually always, these attorneys always have spouses with the men own the business, or it's 50-50. And when it's 50-50 and they both work in the business, then that's really rough because one of them's going to get the business and the other one isn't.
Yeah. How is that often determined?
That's obviously totally up to the judge. I would hope that the judge takes into account what type of business it is and who's more involved in the actual meat of whatever the business is, as opposed to somebody that's doing generic, if you're doing bookkeeping or clerical or HR or something like that, as opposed to like the other spouse is involved in a manufacturing process or something, you know?
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it's probably a lot easier for the judge to decide when one person is the obvious rainmaker, right? Yeah. And the other one is more in a supporting role. There's plenty of businesses that are spousal owned 50-50 where both are rainmakers, right?
Both of
them are vital to the success of that business. I got to imagine that it's very difficult to decide if neither one of them wants to let go. I mean, I'm sure there's instances where somebody will just be like, you know what, just take it. I'll go do something else, or I'll go start my own business with the proceeds I'm going to receive. Mm-hmm. But I got to think that when both of them are rainmakers and both of them want to keep the business, that's got to be so difficult.
Yeah, and if both of them are, I have done it with 50-50, but not usually. Most of the ones I do are not 50-50, but that would be really tough. And I have to say, it's kind of surprising that I haven't run into that situation, but I really haven't.
I guess that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, because I think what I'm about to say doesn't even just account for divorce. This is about anything about a business when there's a forced transition, right? I think everybody always wants to outwardly haggle about the finances and the money and the buyout. Like, that's what we all bang our fists on the table over, is the money. Mm-hmm. But I think what people don't share, but is probably almost of equal importance, is losing the business itself, right? Because, you know, people put blood, sweat, and tears into it, make so many sacrifices, and they'll make it sound outwardly that, well, as long as I get my fair share, I'm good. When in reality, a lot of folks aren't, because they don't want to let go of what they've built.
Oh, yeah. I think you're absolutely right.
And we see that anytime there's a departure of some kind, not just in a divorce situation. Well, this has been great. So just to kind of put a bow on everything, Roxanne, what can business owners do to protect themselves? What should they do, either going into a business venture together with their spouse, or maybe going into a marriage with already an existing business? What are some of the best practices you recommend that spouses do to make sure that if this does happen, if there is a divorce, both the spouses and the business will be adequately protected?
I think the best thing you can do is have written agreements, whether that's an operating agreement, a prenup, or both, and possibly a trust, but that would depend on certain circumstances. And when you have an operating agreement, make sure that it specifies what's going to happen in the event of a dissolution, or if one partner or shareholder wants to leave the business. All of that needs to be spelled out in advance, because you can agree in advance, but once something happens and you're fighting, nobody's going to agree on anything.
And know the value of the business, right?
Yes.
We talk about that in almost all of these podcasts. All of these topics require at least having a Doesn't have to always be a credentialed valuation, but at least have somebody you trust and has knowledge in the space of business valuation keep you informed of what the business is worth. And make sure that these things are updated. We have, I'm sure, I don't know if you've ever seen this, Roxanne, but I'm sure a lot of our attorneys out there that are listening, you know, you talk about those partnership agreements, those buy-sell agreements. They were drafted at the conception of the marriage. Folks are married 40 years and those documents have never been updated.
Yeah, that's true. I've been married 42 years. And when I think about, you know, what we had when we got married and what we have now, everything's totally different.
And the other thing I'll put out there too, when you do get a divorce, when everything is all settled and everybody's kind of gone their separate ways, make sure you update your beneficiary designations.
Yes.
That's kind of one of my parting recommendations for folks. Make sure that your ex-spouse is not the beneficiary of of any policies or, you know, qualified plans or anything like that.
That's true. That
can also cause problems down the line. And make sure that these agreements are funded too. I'll add to that too, Roxanne. You know, I know it's difficult to fund for a divorce. It's not like a death where you can fund it with life insurance. But there are ways that you can fund these agreements with certain financial instruments to help at least ease the burden if there is some kind of buyout and not have to, as you mentioned earlier, Roxanne, borrow funds from the bank or take operating cash out of the business, which could be a strain on the business as well.
Yeah. I've also had owners that they have to pay somebody off for a while as part of a property settlement.
I'm sure that that's common. Very informative. I hope folks think about this as just another way to de-risk their business. Because that's at the end of the day, what we're trying to do here is we want to minimize as many risks to the business as we can. And this is a risk and one that needs to be addressed by the business owner. So thank you so much, Roxanne.
Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Real Business Podcast, where business gets personal. Presented by MassMutual. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. To learn more about our topic in this and other episodes, visit massmutual.com/businessowners. The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own, and the information provided is not intended to be used as legal or tax advice. You should seek advice on legal or tax questions based on your particular circumstances from an independent attorney or tax advisor. Copyright 2024, MassMutual Life Insurance Company. All rights reserved.